outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
Wayne, in your time, in your era, were libraries quiet? Wasn't that like a quiet space back in the day?
Yeah. In fact, you got shushed by the lady at the desk if you made any noise whatsoever.
Ooh, okay, okay. Well, I had a little bit different experience today. I actually went into a library hoping for a quiet space for us to be able to record, and it was like sheer chaos. There was probably 300 kids and their parents running around the library today.
So you're hoping for a quiet space where you could talk, but no one else was talking.
Yes.
Yeah, see that?
Yes, that is correct.
That flies in the face of, I don't even know how to respond to that.
I would have gone into a room that was specific for study, and I could have talked quietly in there. But yeah, it was utter chaos. It was like I was walking into an amusement park going on in the local public library today.
I can't remember the last time I've been to a library.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's do a lot of research there, but I can do it all online now, and I haven't gone. I don't read books, so checking a book out's not helpful. So I read off the e-reader. So yeah.
Okay.
I haven't done library in a long, long time.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have even thought about that about you. I mean, you as an author and a lover of books, a lover of reading, I would have assumed that you've been in a library recently.
It's even worse. I haven't been to a bookstore in probably 10 years.
Really?
And that used to be one of my favorite things, just meander around a bookstore, see what's out there I haven't read yet, or now I can't keep up with things I want to read to even try and figure out to go look for something I haven't read yet. I haven't got time for that at the moment. Maybe when I retire, but then I want to read all the classics, man. I want to go back and reread some and read some I haven't read. And
nice.
When I'm sitting on my front porch, see if anybody wants to come chat at me.
Uh-huh. And when is that said retirement era coming?
as soon as the Holy Spirit says you're done.
So not ever in your lifetime then, probably.
I don't know. Sarah caught me the other day. I started to share a story, and then I got sidetracked, and I didn't get back to finish the story. And so she goes, oh, what about that story you were telling? I'm going, oh my gosh, forgot completely. So I went back to it. But I don't know, 25 years ago, I went with a friend to hear a guy, an author speak that I had read quite a few of his works, but he was older. He's in his 80s. And he had a series of, he'd start a story, forget, and go on a tangent, and then start another story, forget, and start another tangent. Never heard the end of a story, not one.
And oh, wow.
I turned to the person next to me and I said, look, if that ever happens to me, you got to tell me, Wayne, it's time to go home. You're not helpful out here. And so I look forward to that day. I guess I just need to be more senile and then I can get off the trail. Anyway, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey. I'm live from almost St. Louis, Missouri. We're all across Illinois. We're in East St. Louis, actually. I haven't crossed the bridge yet. We will on Thursday, headed for Kansas City. And then after that, Denver. And then we'll wind this trip up and head on home.
So, and then from Denver to California, is that a couple day trip? Is that a 3 or 4 day trip? Like, how long does it take after you leave Denver and start meandering towards Southern California?
Yeah, we probably won't meander. It's 3 days, 2.5 of heavy driving. Can do it in 2, but that's crazy. We don't need to go that fast. And we may take 4 because 4.5 hours a day is about enough for me. So, and I like getting other things done. So docking it somewhere, nice. Getting on to other things.
So if you were going to sum up this road trip with just a few words, what would stand out to you?
We haven't gotten there yet. We even talked about it recently. This thing's been all over the map with the dog issue and the people we've met with and folks that have just kind of been from all over the ecclesiastical map and the theological map. And I don't say there are certain themes that are clear. As far as Sarah and I, there's no real strong theme. There's some memories we've worked with. There's some coping mechanisms that God's brought up. But mostly we've just enjoyed each other and enjoyed where we've been. Yeah, I did see fireflies last week. That's my one main thing for coming back this far. It's a little early in the season, but we first saw them in Virginia and then saw a bunch more in Pennsylvania. And now we've seen more in Kentucky. I don't know about St. Louis. We'll go out tonight and see what we can find. I love little critters. I know people who grew up with them think, well, it's just, yeah, they're bugs. But I grew up in California, man. We don't have any such things. And I find them. I used to read books about fireflies at the library. There was one about some Gus the Firefly or something. And then we saw them at Disneyland, animated animatronic versions of green lights. Mm-hmm. So when I see them in the wild, I just go nuts. I just really enjoy it. We used to chase them at Sarah's house, our parents' house with the kids when they were younger. Went out the other night trying to find them. I saw some way far away. And I'm thinking, oh, I wish there was one nearby. And I'm telling you, just 2 feet off my eyeballs, one just lit up. It was pretty cool. So it's firefly trip. First time we've seen fireflies on the in the RV. How's that?
Okay. You didn't see fireflies on the last round?
Well, we've been in the fall, so we have not. No.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Now we're just short of the Mississippi River. Hmm. Happy to head home.
So I was listening to the podcast that you and Sarah did last week and just thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, I was going, as I was listening to the podcast, Sarah said something that just took me aback. And I don't know if she remembers it or not, but she made the comment that they can't get a free love pass. And it was in the context of salvation and grace. And oh my gosh, that paused me so hard when she said that, because just the phrasing of a free love pass, I think so often we think of, oh no, you don't get a free pass. There's no such thing as a free lunch. You don't get a free pass for anything. And yet to hear her use those words, it just kind of took me aback a little bit and was like, oh, huh, okay. So is there still some religious tentacles that are still hanging on in there, or some religiosity tentacles that are hanging on in there? Because it was interesting. Like I was surprised at how quickly that caught me off guard and how I had to just kind of pause and think about that. But just the idea that they can't get a free love pass.
You don't remember what context used it? Because I don't. We heard it today.
So she was talking about just people in, specifically in religious context, and them being able to process and be available and connecting with life. And there was all these like different rules and laws and requirements. And she made the comment about how people can't just get a free love pass, that there has to be something else that's tagged on to it, or there has to be something else that is connected to it, or there's these do's and don'ts that are tied into that versus just getting a free love pass.
Yeah. Good. Well, something I got this week in an email from someone named Monica in Paris, France, outside Paris, France. Friend of mine, we've corresponded a little bit recently. She writes some poetry. This was in the form of a poem. I'm just going to pull a little bit of it. It's fairly long. I'm going to pull a couple of stanzas from it. It says, "Tell me, you the righteous, capital R, how did you manage to support us? How did you manage not to judge us? How did you manage not to condemn us? How did you manage to love us despite everything? Then tell me, you, the truth. How did you manage to live in our world of lies? How did you manage not to swim in our murky and filthy waters? How did you manage not to confuse reality and dreams? And how did you manage to laugh, smile, and love this world despite everything? And then, so tell me, you, the pure, how do I, like you, live to stay pure? How do I do like you to smile, laugh without lying? How do I do like you, never have a hard heart? How do I live like you and not survive?" Just an interesting tag at the end, because he didn't survive it. How do I live like you, even when it's, I guess, brutal and difficult? I found that very provocative. It gave me kind of a moment to pause and think about, what would it have been like for Jesus to live here, for him to have all of our fallibilities, you know, surrendered his rights to Godhood and lived here in human weakness? How did you negotiate life without lying? How did you negotiate all our pain and still love us? I was captured by those words, because that's how I want to live too. So at the end, it's like, how do you help me do these things? And I've been musing on that this week and finding it encouraging.
And especially the concept of not dying, right? I mean, I don't think necessarily the threat of death is faced all the time in the United States. However, just recently I saw the article about the couple that was doing some missions work in Haiti, and both of them were killed by a gang. And so it's, you know, I think the, how do I live love? How do I live kingdom and it not result in my death? Especially with how starkly it collides with the world systems and the way that we do things and why we do things. And like, you think about Jesus when he was born, like they had to run away to Egypt, right? They had to relocate to Egypt because they were, he was being hunted down, and there was mass genocide that was surrounding his birth. I mean, there was so much that was tied into that. And you think about like, okay, what was Jesus's trauma profile? You know, like he's born like this animal shelter. He has to flee for his life. What was his trauma profile growing up? And how did that not skew his perspective on who Father was or his concept of love in the world? And the rumors that were swirling around his parents, specifically his mom, and like, okay, what, where did Jesus actually come from? Because, you know, he's definitely, you know, he's definitely not, we don't know who the dad is, you know?
Like, so, it's not Joseph's boy.
Yeah.
You know, I thought of when I read that last part about surviving, I didn't think so much about existential survival in terms of life and death. I talked to a lot of people in the last couple of weeks, I think, especially on this trip, who have paid a huge price to follow truth and love in their life, from family, from people they've known forever in some kind of congregational setting, that following the truth, as it has for me, has cost me. It's not, oh, now I know what's true and I've got love and boy, the world will beat a path to my door. Because I think the shock always, particularly when you discover something that's really helped your soul and your heart and helped you connect with Jesus, and you find people who immediately start criticizing the lack of religion in it, the lack of performance, the lack of human effort, the lack of, and then when they try and convince you and you're just unconvinced, how easily they marginalize and push away. I think that's what I thought of. How do I live like you and experience rejection, experience people I used to be close to no longer want to be close to me, and navigate the space where, yeah, love and truth has cost something. As it did for Jesus, even before his death. Yeah. It cost him people and how they treated him and how they wanted to attack him and argue with him in public and do the things that they did. I really love the idea. How did you do this? How did you navigate life? Yeah. And knowing he's right there to help me navigate life in the same way, which is beautiful.
So do you think that Jesus at that time, do you think that Jesus had access to the Holy Spirit?
It says he did. Acts 10 says, yeah. Everything he did by the power of the Spirit. So he didn't do it out of his divinity. He did it empowered. The first fruits of the new generation. Yeah. So I've always thought that. Do you think differently?
No, I just was wondering about that because in his baptism, the Spirit landed on him like a dove. And yet, like at the Pentecost, he tells his followers, his disciples, wait, don't go out into the world until the Spirit comes on you. I'm going to send another to you. And so I was just kind of mulling over that of like as we're talking about that, I was like, okay, what access did he have to the Spirit? And what did that look like in regards to, you know, being able to do this life, being able to live this out in the world when he forsake his divinity, when he gave up that right, when he gave up that access, what did that look like for him? Did he have to learn it?
Yeah, we don't know that part of it. Obviously, it's not said, but we do know that he learned everything he did. He did Acts 10:38, I think, Peter talking to the house of Cornelius. And he was sharing just he did all the stuff, did miracles, did whatever, by the power of the Spirit and not out of his own. So yeah, I've always thought it was that way and think the same thing's available to us. But obviously learning to lean into what the Spirit reveals in our hearts instead of protecting ourselves, instead of doing all the things we do to not lean into the life of the Spirit, I think it is a huge learning curve for us. I don't know how big it was for him. But
yeah, that makes me, I mean, I wonder about that because when I was thinking about it the other day, I had a really interesting experience ranching this week. And one of the feedback things that I had gotten from a good friend when we were talking about trauma and letting go of trauma and what does the healing process look like. And their feedback was, you'll know that God's work is really coming to a resolve in that area of your life when it doesn't have teeth anymore. When you go through a situation that would have been triggering for you or activating for you, and it doesn't have that same visceral experience, or you don't have that need for the coping skills or the reactions that you did. And I think about that, I'm like, okay, when you bring up that question, like, how did Jesus avoid all of that? How did he not go down the road of self-created coping skills or self-created ways of getting through life or survival skills? How did he not, especially as a kid, if he's learning these things, if he's walking through this with Father and he's learning what that looks like, how did he not ever go down that road? I don't know. I don't know how that's possible.
I think that's what Monica's poem's about. Just how did you do it? How did you navigate the space? And I think the mystery of it's outstanding. He learned, even what you're sharing about when there's no more bite in the experience that's been traumatic or triggering. But that's not an on-off switch. I mean, I watched Sarah grow out of that, grow in some areas, still others are causing problems, but it's a growth of learning to lean into the life of the Spirit. And I love that. I think our growth curve obviously is steeper than Jesus's. I mean, I don't know what advantages he had in the sense that he was, you know, he had a sense that even from youth of what his father's business was and wanting to be about it. And he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously a growth curve there, one in which he didn't stumble, which is kind of amazing. But
yeah,
I think the challenges of not stumbling, that's what my Greek professor said, the oak tree that stands the full force of the wind feels it more than the sapling that bends at the slightest breeze. And so that it's not that he felt it less, he felt it more in his ability to stand against it and in his learning to be dependent on the Spirit to accomplish that.
I can't wait to ask him about that, because honestly, like, there's some legitimate question marks there of like, okay, like I can understand in the part God side of you, but the human side of you, I have no idea. I have no idea the concept of what that looks like, of how that could even be feasible.
Well, it's mystery. Mystery until we know, and we don't know. I got this last week, got this the other day. It said, this is from a really good friend. He said, it's rather funny, maybe interesting. I listened to the last podcast with you and Sarah, and I hear such freedom in Sarah's laughter. I can't hear much else beyond that. Wayne, her freedom has affected me as much as your books. Now, that's not fair, but despite it, it's a good comment. It was such a blessing for you to share that with us. Many, many thanks for what you both have done to help me along the way. I love that. Her freedom has affected me as much as your books. That's sweet. Although my books took longer to write, told Sarah, that didn't seem quite fair.
Now, you know, I think there could be an argument that her freedom process has been 60 plus years in the making. So I could don't think one of your books took that long.
Okay. I'll go with that. Fair enough.
If that helps you rationalize it a little bit.
And I got this from Debbie a few weeks back. She says, please thank Sarah for me for the last podcast, not the recent one, but one a few back. I've listened to the Redemption series in the past. I've appreciated her ability to be candid, identify with a story. I too have had horrible things happen to me since I was born. I learned to cope by storing a different part of my brain so I continue to function. I was terrified to face that truth for 60 plus years. I finally became so exhausted from running, and now I want to listen to the little girl inside. All these years, I treated her the way the perpetrators taught her, and I hurt her even more. I like how Sarah said she learned to show compassion for her little self. I am doing that too, and it's wonderful. Listening to her story makes me feel less alone. I remember first hearing stuff about the you know, your inner child stuff, and that, I mean, 40 years ago, and it was all kind of lopped into new agey, kind of spooky, whatever. And, you know, just follow Jesus, just believe Jesus and all that. To watch that become part of the revelation of what had actually happened to her, this childlike part of her brain lets her in there. And then watching her parent, that part of herself that didn't get well parented as a child. And I'm in a conversation with probably five or six people that are doing that right now themselves. They're learning when that part of their brain acts out. Sometimes it's healthy and just letting something in. Sometimes it's recapturing a bit of childhood that was lost. That's kind of innocent and fun. And other times it's a lot of the coping mechanisms are invested there that are very harmful and very hurtful. And so it's kind of a whole range of things that you learn to be inside of with Sarah as they're kind of opening up, and other people are too. And I love that idea of trying of parenting a child that didn't get it when they were young. And so what's the wisdom that you can bring to your inner child, to that part of your brain that got frozen at some point of catastrophe in your life? It's a miracle process. It's amazing.
What element of that does it, I'd be intrigued to hear kind of what Sarah's thoughts are in regards to the staggered process of her parenting that little girl, you know, through Sarah and her maturity, her wisdom, her life perspective, right? But then in the midst of that, isn't she also like her adult self, her current self, learning how to be parented and still experiencing some of that as father is working through that with her and she's going through this healing process? Like, I guess I'm just thinking about it and I'm like, man, as I am, the more that I'm walking with father and the more that I am experiencing as an adult being parented by him, the more I have the ability not only to parent that young person inside of me, but also my daughters as well. And that process of, okay, what does it look like to create space for that person, to be tender to that person? And yet, again, coming back to, we can't offer what we don't know. So if I haven't experienced it, even as the adult person, if father hasn't taken me through that and that experience of being parenting hasn't been redeemed and healed in some ways, then in a lot of the regards, I'm just repeating the same cycles of what I learned and I'm still healing from, right? Because that's all I know. And that's not what I know to offer as a parent.
Obviously, the adult self has to have something to offer the inner child. Yeah. If the adult is still wounded to the same degree, then there's not going to be help for that part of the psyche. Mm-hmm. But I think it's easier, at least I find with Sarah's story, it's easier for the adult part of the brain, more rational, more reasoning, to kind of embrace the reality of God inside of that journey. And as that part of her gets anchored more and more, and I love this still, the growth curve thing that we're talking about earlier, just like following the spirit. There's a curve to these things. I think I grew up with this kind of on off. So either trust God or you don't trust God, either following him or you're following yourself. You just, instead of, no, there's an arc of growing, of the renewing of the mind, of shedding the ways I've acted in my own stead, trying to protect myself, defend myself, try and make a ministry from whatever. There's ways that we've just served ourselves, and learning to lean out of that, especially looking back at my life, especially when a lot of those aspirations seem spiritual. They were self-aggrandizing for Wayne, but they were seemed like that they had scriptures attached to them that were doing it for God, the big lie that we get sucked into with that. But man, leaning into where the spirit dwells, and that's, I think, where you find where a lot of the coping things get disconnected. And I know in Sarah's journey, the first thing that happens is she begins to recognize the trigger before it's triggered her. I mean, she'll feel, that's the thing that triggers me. And when you're aware of it happening, I think that's a good sign that God's already tinkering around in there. And then you're looking for other options, and you're looking for, Sarah does a lot of self-talk, talking to that part of herself that's like, she was nervous today about something and she was just talking about it. And I just, so we process, is there a reason to be nervous about it? What's going on? And just find a way to walk herself past that. But recognizing that it's happening is huge.
Yeah. I agree. I think the recognition, and even that was part of the thing this week that happened. I had an encounter with my dad that would have, in the past, even just 5 years ago, would have still had some teeth to it, would have still been activating to it. And and in that space, it was so different because it didn't have teeth. Not only did it not have teeth, but then I was able to have perspective of what's going on here. Why is this happening? what are some ways that I can encourage and support him? And then he realized what had happened. And so he processed it a little bit with me and what was going on there. But then so the recognition piece, I think, is really helpful and really important. But then there's that next step of, okay, what do I do with that? Like, once I recognize it, so like, for example, okay, now there I recognize that there's a young person, there's an inner child in me, there's a young person inside of me. But now what do I do with that? What do I do with that knowledge? How do I begin to learn how to care for that, to create space for that person without dismissing it or without even being like, okay, well, I recognize that they're there, but this still is kind of weird. This feels a little hokey, you know, but I can't deny it because I recognize that they're there, but like, I don't even know where to go about this. And do you think that a lot of that has come from, like, for example, Sarah having somebody who is experienced in inner child healing or inner child work and walking her through what that parenting process looks like? Or did the person, the therapist that she's working with, did she more tap into some of the skills and some of the experiences that Sarah already had? Or was she building all new skills? I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's a combination. It's been both. I mean, Sarah has some skills, and then it's also been, she did a podcast. I think that's the one that's the email referred to, coming out across Texas. We were talking about the tools that her therapist and conversation with others and God has given her to be able to manage this part of her life. So it's a lot of things, gratefulness to mindfulness to, they're just tools that when these things start to happen. But I wouldn't think, as I've watched it happen, I don't think it's been so global as, okay, I have this little child, I need a parent, how do I do that? It's not it's not on the macro scale, it's on the micro scale. There's this incident, I reacted this way, or I am reacting that way. How do I talk to that part of me? Because I think the inner child language is very weird for some people. Like, it's like there's a little Sarah running around in there, and just a differentiated part of her brain that got kind of isolated because of the experiences that it had and because it didn't have agency to handle it. Now Sarah has some agency. So it's always done incident by incident, thought by thought. That's how we do it. So what does it take now? And I think one time recently, Sarah shared in a podcast about this thing with a grandpa and just shrinking him by, when she has that memory come, she walks her inner child. She does this whole imagination scenario. I walk her out of the room. I close the door and I lock it with grandpa in there. We go to the car, put her in the car seat. We drive home, walk in the door. I turn to her and say, he's not around anymore. It's not, he doesn't determine our life now. And she just has that talk with herself. And over time, and she's had that talk probably 50 times, that the influence begins to shrink. And I like both of that. I've said for a long time, when God works on something in our life, it becomes less intense, less frequent, and less seductive. And I think that's the way God works. We look, I want to see healing. I want this to be immediate. I love the idea, whether it's learning to lean into the Spirit and the life of the Spirit, or whether it's learning to lean out of places of brokenness. That's a great journey to be on. And when you know you're on it, there's so many people that don't know they're on it. I mean, some of the groupy things we've done over the last couple of weeks, you've got people in it who don't know they've got struggles left. They don't know. They're very evident. I mean, you talk to them immediately. Yeah. The arrogance of thinking they've got it all figured out and I know exactly what I'm going to do, and they're posturing. It's amazing how easy it is to see when you've been through that yourself than when you were doing it too. And I love the hunger of people who are aware of this part of the story, that Jesus comes into my life, invites me into his reality. He pokes holes in my illusions, as we've talked about it before. And there's a part of me that resists all that. And I'm not the first one to embrace all that. Something I embrace quickly is usually something I find self-activating. In other words, I want that for me, so I'm trying to get Jesus to give it to me. But where he pokes holes in my illusions, I'm generally resistant initially. And then, maybe there's something to this, to then, Jesus, how do you unravel that in my life? And there's no real specific, here's how you unravel it for me. It's just, the more I learn to live in love, the more that love encompasses that thing. And I watch it unravel. I watched the power of something that had great power in my life before I recognized it. Then when I recognized it, still had power in my life. And then I watch over time as that power just fades until finally it's not even a consideration anymore. Mm. I mean, I'll think of it as, oh, I used to respond that way, but I don't. And that arc has taken years, if not decades. It's not, it's not quick. And that is the renewing of the mind, I think. That is the process of sanctification is not, here, know, hear the scripture, now pretend you're applying it in your life. It's not like that. It's simply, there's a reality here Jesus is showing me. Do I lean into that? And if I don't know how, then I'm asking, I'm looking for ways other people might give me some insight into that. And if I'm not living that way, if I don't have that growth edge in my heart, I think we might want to stop and see, are we really walking with Jesus? Or have we just found some Jesus things we've adopted to make us feel better about ourselves? But whether it's the love message or, I mean, there's so much of that where people talk about, oh yeah, and they're always into the theology of the love message or whether there's a heaven or hell or all those kinds of things, but you don't see them changing. They're more on a theological purity arc than they are on a personal transformational journey, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's also why this journey is described as a very narrow road. Because to stay on this road and to keep at it, it's not easy work. And it does take a lot of time. And so to work through it, and I feel like that's where the tangible, personal, intimate encounters with kingdom are so vital. Because it's like, oh, okay, there is a life, there is hope out there that is more powerful than my ways of getting through life are currently. Yeah. That even though they're familiar and even they may or may not be working, but this taste that I got, this experience that I got, this encounter that I had, and I think it's, I think back over my life, and there's been several instances where I've had very tangible, very concentrated experiences of kingdom. And that's really helped in the dry times, in the hard seasons, in the times where I'm getting impatient or I'm feeling frustrated. It's like, okay, no. Keep my eye on that hope that's in front of me, because I know that there is an invitation to this ever-growing wholehearted life that Father's inviting. It's not some destination in the future. It's an ever-growing experience. It's an ever-growing knowledge and encounter and ability to walk out and live in the freedom of it.
And it takes that engagement like you're talking about. I have to engage him. I have to engage this nudging, this insight that he's giving me inside a circumstance, and then recognize, am I leaning that way or do I lean away from it? And then I end up in a place where I'm going, my life seems dry. I don't hear God. God's not doing anything. I'm going, is that because we've been leaning out for a time? Because yeah, it is challenging. There's a cost to the things that God invites us into. And we seem to intuitively know the cost right away. We're like, oh my gosh, this is going to cost me big time. Let me read this one last email. This is from Mike. Yeah. I keep thinking of the dynamics of your recent podcast that include the character of God as I know it, the defaults of religion as I've experienced it, and what it means to be human. It feels like a complicated process of nuancing. What you say is scary to the religious who inadvertently set up walls that make it challenging to experience a relationship with God. I like that, the whole religious mindset. I used to think I had a better relationship with God than I did because I was doing certain religious things, but I was still not leaning. I wouldn't let him poke holes in my illusions. I kind of resisted the poking. You know, so he said, we get caught between the demanding proclamations of religion and the non-demandingness of the invitations of love. That's beautiful. Mm. I love that. The demands of religion and the invitation. Love is a whisper. And when the religious hear what you are saying, you'll get a quick, harsh response based on fear. It hopes to snuff out the truth you want to convey because it will dismantle its control of things that we were never meant to have. With those who hear your invitation to be in a relationship with God, I imagine it is happening as a door being slightly cracked open, and they cautiously measure the ideas in the quiet chambers of their souls. You will not quickly hear their responses, as they mull the implications in their minds and souls. Thank you for your stubborn love that keeps inviting others to consider that God will meet them if they are brave enough to open that door. Thank you for taking the blunt criticisms of the religious and having enough hope in God's character to believe that by your attempts, his whisper is being heard by those who timidly ponder the beautiful realities that can be true for them. A beautiful email. I love that love is a whisper. It amazes me that so much of the preaching I grew up around was very loud and very angry. It was people on the edge of the pulpit, raised fist in the air. And it just, man, it just pounds at you. Fear pounds at you. Human effort pounds at you. Try harder pounds at you. And the whisper of love is an invitation. Wayne, I have a different thing to show you here if you're open to seeing it. And I, what he describes there is a process I've seen in my life many times. Like God opens, Jesus opens this little door saying, do I come this way? Because you can go that way. But if you come this way and you look in the door going, ooh, that will cost me. There are people who are not going to like that. And there are ways that, just the thing about, I want you to give the transitions recordings away instead of sell them. Just things like that where you look in the door going, okay, that doesn't seem to end well for me. I need some income. I haven't had a book recently. So that, or that invitation to, I have more to teach if you walk away and if you stay at the betrayal of my co-pastor friend. And you go, okay, see, at the moment you hear those invitations, the natural inclination is to run. And I think that's why the religious manipulation of people is always hard. It's angry. It's forceful. But the whispers of love are just an invitation. And I find myself doing that with people when I'm talking to them. I kind of open a door and invite them to it. And I can see them resist it right away. And then the temptation is to double down. We're dealing with life and death here. I mean, you don't see this, then you're going to feel stuck over here like God isn't being fair to me, because that's what we're talking about. But the very door he's opening, you're resisting. And I guess I don't want to be the shout of love. If love is a whisper and we've got to quiet ourselves enough to hear it, me shouting at it, me being the megaphone for love is not helpful to God or them. If the megaphone was helpful, God would have it. So he knows the whispers, the invitations are really where we get on that growth track, that ascending arc of growing freedom and wisdom and light, and where we respond to the pressures and manipulations of the religious voices in our life that do sound, on the outside, they sound less costly because they feed that, oh yeah, that's right, I should be this, I should be that. It's all about control, most of it, taking control back. And the whisper of love is, I've got you. I want you to learn a different way to live. And that way, is more powerlessly, and it will cost you. But I will also, I mean, there's no price I've paid in my 30 years on this side of the living love journey that I would not willingly pay today to have the life that Jesus is bringing into my heart. Not one, including Sarah Levy.
Yeah.
There's not one I would go back and say, well, I can't, I would like to do without that. I mean, there's lots I would like not to have had happen.
Yeah.
But the doors that Jesus opens when darkness assails us is pretty, pretty fantastic.
I love that. And I think the hard part is that often the religious voice or the religious megaphone is also certain and it's detailed, right? It's like, okay, here are the details, here are the steps, here are the 5 easy plans that are going to move you towards this certainty. And so if you do X, Y, and Z, you can be certain that X is going to happen or Y is going to happen and that God is going to come through for you like this. So if you have my level of faith, God will get you a G6 Learjet, guaranteed. Certainty, here it is. Here's the example.
And they will have scripture addresses with each point. Some scripture taken out of context.
Yes.
That you pile those 4 scriptures on top of each other and you go, well, of course, this is what I need to do. And then it doesn't work. The people who really go, okay, I'm going to go down that road. And they go down the road as a matter of routine and they get the end of it and going, okay, it didn't produce what I was promised it would produce. And most, because they're so convinced the process was godly, the blame at the end goes to God, not to the preacher who lied to me. We just read in Jeremiah, Sarah and I, the other day about, I didn't send these prophets. They're lying to you. And you didn't know they were lying. So you followed them. And now you're blaming God because what they said didn't happen, but I didn't send them. They weren't speaking my words to start with. And that's what hurts me the most. The people who end up disillusioned with God because they followed a man or a woman, usually an angry man or woman. They gave him all those three, five points to, this is how you possess it. And they did that, did it hard, paid a big price for years, and it didn't work. Yeah. And then they grow incredibly disillusioned. And what I love about the whisper of love we're talking about, it finds its way into the darkest pain in our life and lights a path through it. Doesn't always take it away, although it can, but it lights a path. If you'll follow this path, and then this is what I was thinking about. I love being a free pass. Just because God loves you doesn't mean it stops the consequences of not following him. The invitation of love is, come follow me. I'll bring you life. And where we go, nah, I can't follow. I can't do it. And then Jesus, make an exception out of me. Just give me the goodies without me trusting your insights and leaning into that space.
The image that I just always get about it is like it's this like image of me being on a ship, like an adventure, you know, like a sailing ship, a traditional old school sailing ship. And there's this major bank of fog that's sitting there. And there's like a clear seas over here, wide open, easy, you know, lots of sunshine. And then there's just this murky, dark fog bank that's over here. And it's like this whisper comes out of the fog bank of, my life is here. There's adventure to be found here. Like, turn into this. You won't be able to navigate on your own. You won't be able to navigate in your own sight, in your own will, in your own strength. But I will show you a way through this. When I turned my ship into that and into that adventure, like, yeah, there are times where the fog breaks and there's beautiful clarity and I get to see the world and his kingdom and his reality in a beautiful way. But then usually it's a lot of sailing through the fog bank and following those echoes and those nudges and those inclinations of like, okay, here we go. We're going into this.
That's what I hope people learn. Because when you meet a hungry heart like that, and I've been with a lot of people in the meetings the last few weeks, we've had quite a bit of bigger things than I normally do. And you can see it in the room. You could see the hunger, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the hunger of, man, I'm sorting out stuff and I'm open to this kind of conversation. And those who kind of have it all figured out and are trying to convince me that I could give people quicker, simpler answers. And I'm, other than presence, other than Jesus himself walking with you, opening doors, and you recognize, rather not go through that door, but knowing that life, where else are we going to go? That's where I've always come down to, just like Peter says, I don't like that door right there. But if it's you, then that's the way to life. And you have to get in the door to see the light. Then you go, okay, now I get it. But in the initial stages, it's just, I've got to trust him. I've got to lean into the space he's prodding me into. And if I'm unsure of it, talk to some people. See if some people will kind of comment on it and then lean into it. Because there's no better way to live than inside that reality.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.